You're listening to the Christian Humanist Radio Network, ChristianHumanist.org.
Welcome to a special episode of the City of Man podcast. My name is Coyle Neal, and I am an associate professor of political science at Southwest Baptist University in Bolivar, Missouri. Today we have something special for you. This episode was recorded as a panel presentation at the Batman and Popular Culture Conference hosted by the Department of Popular Culture at Bowling Green State University in Bowling Green, Ohio. Panelists included me, Danny Anderson of the Sectarian Review, and Christopher Mav Maverick, also host of the Vox Populorum podcast. Information about our various podcasts can be found at ChristianHumanist.org with the blog post that will go up with some show notes attached. The topic of the panel is race, and we cover a wide range of topics, everything from the 1940s Batman serials to the question of whether or not race can be organically integrated into contemporary Batman stories without it feeling heavy-handed, that it disrupts the flow of the story. These and several other topics are covered in the course of the hour that follows. Enjoy.
This roundtable. Anderson from Mount Aloysius College, Neil Coyle from Southwest Baptist University, and Christopher Matt Maverick from Duquesne University. Thank you.
That's the order we should follow then.
Okay, sure.
So I should talk first. Okay. Well, welcome everybody to this panel. Coyle Neal, they have his name backwards in the program and on his tag, which is funny. But this panel was originally called, I think we proposed it as
The Unbearable Whiteness of Being Batman.
Yes, which was obnoxiously punny, and we're better off that they just put Batman in whiteness. But I think it comes out of a question about a kind of reticence about the issue of race in Batman, and I'm particularly mostly conversant with the cinema, and I know Mav is like a super expert on the comics themselves, and Coyle is actually the one who came up with the idea for this thing, and so he's more than just here. So just to let you know, we are recording this. We each, all three, do separate podcasts, and so if you do want to ask a question, feel free to ask a question, but let us know if you don't want that recorded for the show, and we'll figure a way to cut it out. My name is Danny Anderson. I teach English at Mount Aloysius College, and I do a podcast called the Sectarian Review Podcast, and we look at a number of things: high culture, pop culture, religion, politics, always somewhere in that X, but that's kind of what we do. And I'll let Mav introduce himself.
Oh, we're going out of order. Okay. I don't care.
I'll let Neil Coyle go next then.
Neil, hi.
My name is Coyle Neal. I teach government at Southwest Baptist University in Bolivar, Missouri. And I'm the host of a podcast called the City of Man podcast, which is part of the same network as Sectarian Review, where we talk about issues and big ideas and so on, all of the sorts of things you would expect a political podcast to talk about, and a few that you wouldn't expect it to talk about, I suppose. Kind of our shtick is we have a conservative and a liberal on, and I don't know that there's anything else that sets us apart from any other politics podcast out there, but I don't listen to my own podcast, so I couldn't tell you
that. My name is Chris Maverick. You can call me Mav, and I teach English. I'm a PhD student. I'm a year PhD student at Duquesne University. I'm ABD, where I do a lot of work with comics and superheroes, but also all pop culture, from professional wrestling to television to music. I was a pro wrestler for a while, true story. And I am the host of the Vox Popcast, www.voxpopcast.com, which is my show, where the idea of that one was, why don't we do an an academic roundtable every week with a mixture of academics like us and regular people who are fans of whatever topic we happen to be talking about that week. Lately, it's been a lot of academic stuff because it's conference season and everybody on the show was getting ready for papers that were coming up. But we've had things on action movies. We've had things on politics, on video games, on monster movies was one of my favorite episodes. And it's just whatever we come up with, we have academic conversations with regular people and academics, wherein I drink beer the entire time. So it's going to be very interesting doing this show sober today. And also, I've been instructed that I'm not to swear because I'm not allowed to on their shows. But there's our show is not necessarily child friendly. It's an academic conference where you're allowed to curse.
It's not my choice. It's just sort of the network we're a part of is the Christian Humanist Radio Network, and I'd have to go back and cut out these things. And so,
and I am not.
There's lots of violence on the network. Just no profanity.
Lots of violence. Lots of every other vice. But yeah. So let me just kind of get us started. And the way we've this is arranged as a round table. So be very quickly prepared to feedback, to give us feedback here. We are each going to take just a couple of minutes to kind of share some thoughts on this issue. Coyle, I know you're going to be talking about a particular version of Batman, this 40 serial, which is sort of overtly racist, right? So that gives us something concrete to talk about here. But then we'll just sort of take 5 minutes and kind of share out some initial thoughts, jot down any ideas, and feel free to push back. I know that my comments are a little bit unformed, actually, and I have more, I think, questions than answers. But to the question, should I go first?
Absolutely.
Okay, yeah. So to the question of the kind of seeming like whiteness, and particularly the cinematic universe of Batman, there's very few exceptions to this rule. I was just sort of thinking about this in terms of kind of radical politics, I suppose. And so initially, I was thinking of Umberto Eco's Myth of Superman as a way to sort of explain the kind of lack of radical action in and also Batman. And I know this is one of our earlier keynote speakers had brought that up, and I was really happy. At one point near the end of that essay, Eco says, each of these heroes is gifted with such powers that he could actually take over the government, defeat the army, or alter the equilibrium of planetary politics. And later on, he says, instead, Superman carries on his activity at the level of the small community where he lives. And I think this kind of critique is meant to be more applied to superheroes in general. Superman was kind of emblematic of that. And so my thinking on that is race is certainly part of kind of a radical political critique. And other people who know Batman's comics much more than I do even, they've already made the comment this weekend about Batman fighting to support the status quo, right? There, he's basically, there's a way to read him as a millionaire protecting his own interests, right? And all the kind of activity he does doesn't actually change the system, but rather protects the material conditions that give him the privilege of being a billionaire. And so applying this to race, and here's where I haven't fully fleshed this out, so I would appreciate any help. I've recently been reading Assad Haider's book, Mistaken Identity, about race and class in the age of Trump is the subtitle of that. And the way he kind of narrates this, and it's sort of a critique of liberal identity politics, and he's sort of a leftist writing here. His critique is that they've taken a political stance that was at one time quite revolutionary. And he goes back to the Combahee River Collective, which were, I think, a group of black lesbians who leveraged their identity, their personal kind of identities, racial and sexual identities, as a means towards a collective political action. And then he sort of looks at people like Huey Newton and Black Panthers as taking up that kind of tradition and sort of narrates a switch in which liberalism, and this is, again, one of those places you have to kind of disentangle the left and liberals for the sake of Haider's book here. The left critiques liberals as settling on identity as the end of politics and not as a means towards collective radical action, right? And so mainly his book is an elaborate explanation of that process. And how I'm thinking about this may work with Batman is that Batman, in the way that he is also kind of blind to his class issues, or perhaps purposefully blind to those class issues as a way to maintain his status quo, he also is blind to the race issue, or at least his universe is blind to the race issue. And my thinking is it's using Hayter's paradigm, except he's not privileging race. He's sort of eliminating race as a potential for collective action. So by cutting that out of the narrative, that's one more way which helps Batman sort of support the system as it is, for that supports his class. And so in some ways, Batman presents the same problem as the kind of liberal technocrat for folks like Hayter. And I promised to give myself only 5 minutes to talk about this. One thing I did want to kind of talk about as a potential exception, the Superman Red Sun comic, which Chris and I talked about on my show once, actually, is an interesting version of Batman. And Coyle's our conservative, and I had to do this just to see if he'll have a heart attack. But I have the Superman hammer and sickle t-shirt on here, like underneath there, just to see if Coyle...
I'm a Green Lantern fan.
He seems fine. Yeah. He seems fine. But that vision of Batman does kind of step up for radical change in that world, right? But again, it would be in support of a capitalist paradigm. It was just the paradox of that. But the more important point I want to make there, that Batman ends up dying for the cause, right? And to go back to Echo's point about Superman and other superheroes never instituting any kind of radical structural change is because that would sort of be entering onto a timeline in which they disappear and die, right? So you kind of create these loops in which things happen but don't move history forward at all. And so I think that the lack of race is sort of a resistance to a broader reticence about changing the systems that support the millionaire class, the billionaire class, in Wayne's point. So before anybody takes pictures of me and gets me fired, I'll cover this stuff up. So, and then I'll let, I guess, Chris, do you want to go?
I can go, yeah. Okay. Because you have a very specific thing you want to talk about.
So I'm writing a response to you too, so please.
Yeah, all right, no problem. So for me, one of the things that I think that is interesting, and I pick up right where Danny left off, about Batman as a character type. And I want to go back to the very beginning of Batman, Detective 27 through, let's say the first 12, 13 issues, which nobody reads. But I'm aware that Josh has, because from earlier in this conference. But if you go back and look at them, and I taught them in a class recently. I taught a class recently called Sex, Violence, and Comics, where we talked about the ways that Batman introduces, we read those comics, introduced gender. And there was a curious thing that some of my students noticed, which was they immediately picked up on the fact that in the very first appearance of Batman, Detective Comics number 27, something that everyone at this particular conference is going to know, there are zero women. And I mean zero women. There is not an incidental woman drawn in the background. Gotham City is a city composed entirely of men, specifically entirely of white men. There are no children. There are no women. They are incidentally white male characters, and even as background characters. And that continues in the next several issues. The only time anybody is not a white male is when they have a very specific, or a white middle-aged male is when they have a very specific reason not to be. So if you need a female to be rescued, then the character can be female. If you need a villain to be othered, then the villain can be of some race other than white. 28 introduces the character of Jihad, who is, do they call him a Cossack? Or he's an Indian. And he is, I'm going to say pink, but purplish. It is very ethnically, I was looking for a picture and I couldn't pull one. It is very ethnically problematic. And he wanders around with what they believe to be a traditional head garb, but he almost looks like a – it's what you would do if you were trying to create a genie character in the 1930s and 40s. He is extremely problematically drawn, and this is true of every character that will happen after that, of the Asian characters, of the – they are continuously othered, and I'm using that in the Edward Said version of what racial otherness comes from. And this brought to mind for me a conversation that I had on a blog posting that I made a couple of years ago, I wrote a thing several years back where I was doing I work with a lot of popular culture, and I was doing an investigation of the website Pornhub. They have Pornhub, believe it or not, has great metadata. And they what they do, you don't have to actually watch Pornhub, it doesn't matter. They release their stats. Their stats are fascinating. And they release their stats with, here are by genre type, what is most searched for, and by state. And one of the most, there's very obvious things, like you'll see bondage, you'll see lesbian, you'll see, but then the top racial category was Asian, followed by Oriental. And then later you might see black or white or Hispanic. But I was looking for races to see what people search for. And Asian's number one, and then Oriental is number two. So I wrote this thing where I was talking about fetishizing Orientalism. And a non-academic friend of mine said, you shouldn't use that term. And I was like, what term? He says, Oriental. And I was like, well, I'm not using – he's like, well, people are Asian. And I was like, yes, I understand that. But do you not know what the word means? And it never occurred to me that non-academics don't use the word Orientalism. But he didn't – he was like, well, Orientals are things and Asians are people. And I was like, I understand. And what we're specifically talking about is using people as objects, which is why we use the term that way. And that's when I really started to understand sort of the – now my friend – is a Korean guy who was making this complaint, by the way. So it became clear to me at that point of what we do academically is also sort of an odd othering in a sense by using that term. So now we use it intentionally because we're talking to the idea of creating, of using people as objects. That's why Said picked the word that he did. So I wanted to fast forward through there because the first depiction of incidental race that I could find when I was looking through the history of Batman, I was speaking with this Coyle earlier, is Eartha Kitt as Catwoman in 1966 when she just sort of incidentally replaced Julie Newmar as Catwoman on the television series because Julie Newmar was busy. Every other time up until then, any character that is not white by default is otherized because of their race. Catwoman was a villain, but she was allowed to be black in and of herself, at least comically on television, in being Eartha Kitt. And that continues with the introduction of Billy Dee Williams as Harvey Dent in the first Batman film, 1989. So I'll turn it over to you.
Again, I also am not a Batman expert. If I take nothing else away from this conference, it's that there is a ton of Batman stuff out there. No one person, I'm sure, can ever consume it all, but it's all out there. So in preparation for this, I binge-watched the 1943 Batman serial. I do not recommend this, but I did it. And it's got basically, if you haven't seen it, all of the stuff you would expect the something made in the 1940s with a Japanese character as the villain to have, all of sort of the standard anti-Japanese stereotypes, which is interesting given that they even explicitly in the first episode highlight the fact that the, and this is a direct quote, the wise government policy has cleared out all of the Japanese people from Little Tokyo in Los Angeles, I think is where it's supposed to be. It's Gotham, but of course, if you're living in 1943, you know the law says 10 miles from the Pacific Ocean, so it's going to be somewhere on the West Coast. Literally, the only Japanese person in town is the villain, this Prince. Oh, we don't have the thing, Prince Daka, right? Which of course you also have the the background problem, the behind the scenes problem of there are also no Japanese people working in Hollywood, because by law they can't be, because they're not allowed to be within 10 miles again of the Pacific Ocean. Again, this is kind of a problem on two levels. But in terms of the narrative, it's a difficult problem that the screenwriters, they handle as well as I suppose any serial writer can handle, because Daka, the villain, can't just be the stereotype. Otherwise, there would be no serious conflict. If he isn't at least the equal of Batman, and maybe even ideally the superior in some ways of Batman, you're not going to get 15-minute episodes out of it. Batman would just catch him, and that would be the end. So there's sort of a leveling of Batman and the Japanese villain, or again the not really Japanese villain, as you can tell on the picture there. So Batman becomes significantly less competent, and in the 15 episodes, Batman does not win a single fist fight anywhere in all of them. And that's not an exaggeration. He doesn't win any fights in the episode unless he is assisted by at least two other people. So Robin alone is not enough to do it. And at the end, sorry, spoiler alert, at the end, Batman doesn't even kill the villain. It's Alfred Pennyworth who does it accidentally. So, again, it's...
Go, Alfred.
Yeah. Batman is really brought down, and of course, Daka is elevated. He has gadgets. He has complicated plans. He has a network of allies. He has lots and lots of henchmen, which I suppose isn't that unusual. Batman, again, he has himself and Robin, who really isn't a whole lot of help along the way. Even more than that, the two of them are paralleled in other ways. So they're both government agents. Batman is an agent of the government. Daka is an agent, of course, of Imperial Japan. They both live behind facades that kind of mask the reality. The facade that Daka hides behind is this chamber of horrors showing how terrible the cruel Japanese are. And it is, I'm not like sugarcoating that. That's exactly what that is. To get to his lair, you have to ride a little trolley through all of these, you know, wax figures of Japanese people doing awful things. And there's a front man in front of the building shouting about how we're doing this for America. And this is what's going to happen to all of us. And that's why this building is even open in the first place. And you get to the very bottom and there's a cave where Daka holds his secret meetings. Batman, of course, has exactly the same thing, right? Not exactly the same thing, but you have Wayne Manor that's on top of a cave, right? The facade of kind of the affluent American lifestyle, covering over the reality of what's going on underneath. Both of them even brand criminals. So the Christopher Nolan movie actually, the Batman versus Superman movie does not invent that. It goes all the way back to the 1943 when he captures someone, he stamps them on the forehead before he turns them over to the police, so the police will know who it's from. Daka also brands criminals, although of course they're his allies, and the way you get into the lair is showing the brand. So again, lots of interesting things going on. It is all of, as Danny said, it is sort of awfully racist, even for the time. But it's not just that, and I think it's probably mostly for screenwriting purposes again, because you got to get 15 episodes out of it. But there does end up being a little more complexity, which isn't to say that I think it's great. It's not a great series. no one would watch this for fun today, only for an academic conference. But anyway, that's all I've got to say.
I mean, that does also bring up the whole sort of whitewashing kind of issue that you see even with Batman Begins with Liam Neeson, you know, being right. cast. And so this is almost predicts that as well. I know we talked a little bit
about that before. Liam Neeson is when Batman Begins came out, it was fascinating because they didn't. Oh, does anybody remember what is his official name in the movie?
Roz.
Yeah. And they denied because people were like, oh, no, he's not Rachel Gould. And they were and they denied it when people were like, oh, well, he's clearly Rachel Gould. And it's like, no, he's not. Nope. And then you watch the movie and it's like 20 minutes in. I am Rachel. Of course you are. Yeah. Of course you're Rachel Gould. Because up until that point, and actually even since then, Rachel Gould, who is auspiciously Arabic generically, is almost always drawn as just a white guy. He's very Caucasian. He is usually cast as Caucasian whether he's in Arrow, the television series, or Gotham. Very rarely do they put any ethnicity into it, which partially, I guess, in the 21st century is to sort of protect them from racial stereotype problems, because race is nothing but stereotype. But also it's problematic in that I don't think they really knew what else to do back when he was invented. And then Liam comes in and he does, he's actually, I think he's really good in the role, but he does that in a way that is sort of, how do I not problematize further something that was problematically generated? Because to do it's the Iron Man 3 problem, right? Yeah. To make the Mandarin what comic book fans wanted it to be, which is the classic Mandarin, would be a movie that you cannot produce in Hollywood today.
Right.
So
I've heard similar things about the Doctor Strange movie with
Tilda Swinton becomes character, yes.
Where the director basically came out and said, look, someone was going to be unhappy no matter what I did.
Yeah. And so, yeah. And it's like, if you, when people are like, oh, well, we want the ancient one, we want Asian representation. It's like, go back and read those comics. You don't want that. You might want a more positive version, which is what they did with Wong. They turned him into a better character than he classically is. But the ancient one from those early Strange Tales. And also, by the way, Dr. Strange was vaguely Asian-ish in those early books. You don't want what they were trying to do. Ditko had problems.
And be fair and to complicate it a little bit, I know that in your presentation yesterday, I had asked you about the casting of Jada Pinkett Smith in Gotham, right? And I think that you gave a really great answer about needing to insert a character that no one knew what would happen to them, right? But there was also a great opportunity there to kind of diversify and the world of Batman a little bit there. Which incidentally, I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, please. I have a question for you, but I don't want to interrupt your thought.
One kind of side thought that just came to me while Mav was talking is I kind of also feel like cinematically, Gotham always looks like it's 1940. And so I think there's like a heavy film noir influence about the invention of that city. And I wonder if the racial politics of 1940, the representational politics of 1940, a film noir in general, get imported with the architecture somehow. And it's somehow unintentional. Mm-hmm. And it's why we don't see people of color.
I mean, in real 1940, black people existed, I assure you.
But not in movies. Yeah, well, they did. And there were some exceptions to that in film noir.
But again, you didn't want to be the characters that were exceptions.
And film noir was like surprisingly progressive in many ways, right? I'm thinking back to all those Humphrey Bogart movies, and you have Sam, I guess, in Casablanca, right? But by the way,
it's not bad. Sam is a relatively, for 1940s film, Sam is an extremely progressive character.
Absolutely, yeah.
He can talk back. He says boss. I mean, he's clearly an underling, but he's way more equal than Mammy in every other film.
True.
But also not set in America, though, either.
That's true, too. Yeah.
Get around that. Mm-hmm. So I actually had a question about the thing you brought up, which ties in a question that I wanted to ask in a previous panel. And I think this argument about Batman is upholding the capitalist state in the previous panel are sort of racial structures in this panel. And my question is, look, if we take that idea and let's apply it to any Batman comic book or any let's apply it to Batman Begins. Right? Let's say that Batman has read this book and Ra's al Ghul rolls into town and says, I'm going to burn down Gotham City. Batman says, you know what? I read this this book called Mistaken Identity. If I save this city, I am just upholding the existing racial structure. Mm-hmm. So the practical application of this would then be what?
Let the city burn? Is that what you're asking?
Yeah. So, I mean, it does sound sort of like, or again, if it's capitalism that we're by saving the city, he's just protecting the existing capitalist power structure. Yeah, he's also protecting everyone who lives in the city.
I would say, as Gotham's number one employer, he could, pay everybody $20 an hour so they wouldn't live in poverty and create the conditions in which crime, arises. So before Ra's al Ghul even shows up, I think he could have done something. And I think that's kind of that's how I understand Echo's critique of the superhero in general. They have the power, and where Superman can fly and melt things with his eyes and stuff, but Batman has the economic power to structurally change his world. Right?
He does, and recent comics have sort of tried to deal with that. not primarily, but there are in the last 5 or 6 years, it is acknowledged that Bruce Wayne has many, many charitable foundations that do a lot of good. Because if you look at 80 years of Batman as a whole, Batman just, I mean, say what you will about murder of his parents, blah, 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 justice. Bruce just likes to beat people up. I mean, he enjoys it, because otherwise, there's a line in, I was talking about, there's a line in the Defenders television show that we were talking about the other day, where Luke Cage confronts Danny Rand and says, "Why are you doing this?" And Danny's like, "I'm fighting for justice. I'm the Immortal Iron Fist." And Luke's like, "You're rich. Just go fix the problem. You've got better power." He looks like, "I've got to punch people. I don't have any other options. Just go and shut the drug trade down. You're rich." And Danny goes, "Oh yeah." And then he tries to do that. It doesn't work. But
yeah,
Bruce,
it doesn't work.
But Bruce, no,
but it's just money the problem.
Well, but Bruce kind of can, because you really. So I when we were planning this panel, I sent them, if you've never seen it, pull up on YouTube there's a Saturday Night Live skit of Batman, or Bruce Wayne's Thanksgiving charity event from this last year, where he just kind of goes, and he's Bruce Wayne, and he invites a lot of underprivileged children and their parents to Wayne Manor for a big Thanksgiving dinner. And while they're all hanging out, they all start talking, "We've got to do something about Batman. Why is Batman always in our neighborhood? You know, like my friend was just jaywalking and Batman beat him up and hung him from a gargoyle by his underwear." And it's like, "Did he break his jaw? For show." Like, and Bruce just likes to beat people up. That's part of it. Whereas Clark Kent in early Superman comics, if you read those, Clark is very Marxist in the beginning. Bruce is very much protecting the capitalist system. It's hegemonic masculinity. As we said, he doesn't want progression. He's doing justice, but a very specific kind of justice. In a very early Action Comics comic, Superman knocks down the city to force the government to he basically destroys all the bad parts of the city, knocks down all the projects, not because he hates poor people, but because he wants to force the government to rebuild them, because he knows the new buildings will be better.
Usually, as a conservative, I do have to say, because government built housing is always superior.
Yeah, there's a lot of flaws in the logic of,
they didn't,
well,
know that in the 50s.
Yeah, yeah. 40s. It was like 40s, it's like, yeah. 39, and it's like his assumption was like, "Oh, I'll just knock down all the buildings, they'll build new ones, it will be fine, and of course the same price," which it doesn't work. Like it is a very simplistic, and but remember, this is being written by two guys who grew up in the projects in Cleveland, this is their first real job. Seemed like a good idea at the time, was who Siegel and Schuster were. So it was a very simplistic Marxist view, but they tried.
Yeah, and I
guess
it feels. And again, you guys are the Batman experts. You can tell me I'm wrong, but based on the movies I've seen and some of the comic books I've read, the issue is we are kind of reading into it what Bruce Wayne is or is not paying his, you know, employees in Wayne Tech or whatever it's called.
Yeah, sure.
Right? It may be that he is, you know, genuinely. Refusing to hire minorities, or he is genuinely, you know, for the purpose of this panel.
Well, Lucius Fox is a common character. He's one of the rare exceptions where he's the black guy that works for Bruce.
Right, and
not only works for Bruce, manages his company.
Depending on what era of the comics you are, yeah.
Right. So I mean, they're comics about Batman going out and beating up. Like, that's what the comic is about.
Yeah.
It's not about the socioeconomic conditions of the people that Bruce hires or doesn't hire.
Because they want people to read it who aren't me, yes.
Right.
Because
right,
I would totally read that book. Ooh. Right. Board meetings, yes. I'm in. I'm weird.
So, just sort of my point is, like, we don't have that information. So what we do is we read into it what we want to read into it. So as the conservative, I didn't say, yeah, but he's probably paying his employees whatever the work they're doing is worth. And some people that'll be less and some people will be more. And again, presumably, if you're on the left, you're going to want to have a different reading of that. And all of that's fine. I don't know that any of us actually have the text on our side in that, because what we see Batman doing is punching the Joker.
Punching people, yeah.
Yeah. Usually bad people.
There's some moral ambiguity.
Sure.
Yeah, and just one last thing, though. In the last panel, James McGrath, who's gone, he quoted Nietzsche about whoever lives for the sake of combating an enemy has an interest in that enemy staying alive, right? I think that that's one of the ways in which Batman's activities over time are not meant to actually fix the problem that causes the crime in the beginning, right? It's meant to perpetuate the system that causes the crime so that he can then enact his personal revenge, his sort of individual kind of interest in exercising his demons in perpetuity, as Nietzsche would say, eternal recurrence, right? I don't know what I said that for, but that has something to do with this. So,
you guys want to open up for questions?
Yeah, I would love that.
So,
that would
be awesome. Yeah.
Yeah, just start in front.
Well, I did a presentation yesterday on kind of just how the Batman comics interface with diversity, whether it's social, whether it's moral, whether it's racial. And I could have said a lot more because it's past the time, but I think the common denominator in generally is the needs of the superhero genre. Mm-hmm. Those are kind of like what the writers I quoted tend to always discuss, because if, you know, the needs of the superhero genre rely on, you know, conflict between a hero and a villain resolved by violence. And it does definitely become problematic when you're involving, like, economic facts, like, you know, millionaires and stuff. I know that, like, there are Batman comics that generally assign the problems of Gotham to, like, the mentally ill. Mm-hmm. It's not just a case of, like, him finding somebody to fight, but, like, the people who are like him who are, like, you know, arguably crazy. But generally, I think that once you arrive at the fact that, you know, the way that they treat minorities and the way that, like, they're depicted and the needs of Bruce Wayne, all kind of stuff, I go back to, like, the creators and what are the creators interested in? And you have writers like Dwayne McDuffie or Alex Simmons who generally are aware of the problems in the genre. And then by that point, it's usually meet editors that kind of say, well, okay, sooner or later, we can't keep on talking about this. We have to move on to a villain hero conflict, and certain minority characters get tossed away, or certain issues get failed to resolve, and the status quo continues. So I think what you guys are all talking about, like, you know, pretty quickly arrives at, it's not so much how do we solve Batman, how do we solve the superhero genre, because you can see this in any superhero show, any superhero movie.
Absolutely.
It's all about the needs of the genre and how that genre is racialized to the needs of the people creating the genre.
I totally agree with that. Mav was on my show once talking about Miracle Man, and because I'd asked him, because I was racking my brain, like, is it even possible to have a leftist superhero? I mean, would that even work in the genre, right? And I still can't see it working, just because it subverts the the form.
Someone's panel yesterday, I don't even remember who, so apologies, but it's an argument I've made as well, said that one of the tricks with superheroes is there's an illusion of progress. We can't actually solve problems because to do so would mean there's no next issue.
That's Echo's point.
Yeah. And, yeah. Echo absolutely makes that point in what is the Superman essay? What's it called?
Myth of Superman.
Myth of Superman. Yeah. There's a constant, you know, the perpetual publication model means you constantly have to reset to the status quo and yet make it seem like good things are happening. But, you know, Batman has to be hegemonic, because to make the world better means that you end up in Miracle Man. Miracle Man and the later issues essentially creates a utopia, and it's a very different kind of storytelling. Go back and listen to that episode of Danny's show. And if you can find it, read Miracle Man. It's brilliant. And unfinished, so you'll be like at the end.
Let's go around the room this way.
I actually had not even a question or just something I wanted to expand on what you had said. Well, it was something really interesting. So we don't know, like, what the last comment you just said, sometimes we don't know. And this is something I do with my students. And I take a lot of this from the work by Duncan and Smith, Power of Comics. And they talk about this idea of synecdoche, enclosure. And this idea that, and I think you're right. I mean, we bring a lot of the knowledge. Comics, they argue, is an active medium. I totally agree. We have to bring some meanings with us. And depending on our politics, our gender, whatever, those meanings might be a little different. And it makes for a pretty cool discussion. So, and they say, you know, the meaning ultimately lies with the reader. So I think you're right. We don't know what Bruce pays his employees. We don't know some of these gaps. And depending on our politics or whatever, sometimes I think we fill those in. So I wanted to expand on that. I think it was really
Yeah, and just to step over and join Danny on the economic left for a minute, which is much easier for me. I'm not really an economic conservative for the most part, but the publishers, of course, want the narrative to be as open as possible to appeal to as many people as possible. So yeah, everyone, whether you're liberal or conservative or communist or libertarian or whatever, everyone wants to see the bad guy get chucked in jail, right? I mean, that's something that we all want. And once you start filling in blanks, you start alienating people. So you have to leave that as open as possible, which maybe just says it is really all about the market. So maybe I've moved back away from that.
Typical.
That's a good point.
Yes, sir.
So I had two things. One, I thought I'd love to hear your thoughts on the fact that we've got a character that's got 80-year history. He's got so many different presentations, right? That when we try to talk about Batman in a unified way, if there's not a danger in us participating in a kind of essentialist reading of him, which I read as very akin to the way that white supremacists read the world, right? That we can reduce people down to these essentials and then create hierarchies, right? But the other thing I'd like to get your thoughts on is something from Afrofuturism, right? That thinks about race as a technology instead of thinking of it as a kind of strict social contract. And maybe we can read Batman in his relationship to technology as an allegory for his relationship to race. And that might give us a different way of thinking about how Batman is racialized. So that might feel like throwing bombs in the room, but I'd love to hear your thoughts on those things.
Well, I'll defer your first question to Chris because that's kind of his thing, that whole the multiverse of Batman.
Yeah. Right?
But on that topic, the Afrofuturism, one critique I have heard of Hayter's book, and I think you're totally right, is that it can a little bit tend towards the Afro-pessimistic lens. And so I think that is a great critique of what I just said, for sure. And I'm willing to accept it, for sure, yeah.
I'll address the first thing you asked first, which is, I'm going to simplify your question slightly, but many different versions of Batman, do we read them as essentialist? If we essentialize them, are we essentially codifying the narrative? Yes. Yes, I think we are. Do I have a solution for that? I mean, I am not of the opinion that you can just make racism go away by just casting a black man as James Bond or as Batman or as Superman. I understand why people want it. I will be first in line to see Idris Elba shoot people as 007. I'm looking forward to it. I hope it happens. But I also did not believe that you could just make a black man president and then racism went away. Mm-hmm. That seems more important, and it didn't quite work. So, surprise, there's still racism in the world. And I don't think it's that easy. I think that as big a fan of comic books as I am, obviously, and everybody else in this room, I don't think they're magical. I think that they are stories, and I think they allow us to sort of think about ideas. And Danny alluded to the fact that my dissertation and a talk that I gave at his school, I talked very much about multiversal theory and the idea that there's multiple inheritance in a narrative. Nobody's read all of Batman. Nobody in the world living today has read all of Batman. It's currently impossible. I entered Batman. The first thing I ever saw was, as a little kid, I saw Super Friends. Then I saw Batman 66. And then I started reading comics. And I've got a whole bunch of stuff meshed in my mind. But when you look at when you saw Tom and Martha get shot, or when you saw, where you enter the narrative doesn't matter. The story's all meshed together in your head. You have your own idea of Batman. And if I suddenly make Batman Denzel Washington for one day, that's never going to overcome the 80 billion other white pictures of Batman that you have in your head. It's just not that simple.
Yeah, I guess my point is, then wouldn't one solution be to narrow the field and say we're talking about this specific version of Batman?
I think so.
Relationship to race.
I think that, and I think you can do that. I think that's like when Danny talks about Superman, he's usually talking about Red Sun, which is one very specific story that is not all of Superman. When we did that episode, let's deconstruct this one story. And I think you can do that. I think it's almost the problem with racial swaps in characters. It's what every time you do it, you're going to get some pushback just from people who are, that's not my Batman. You can't do that. And waving fist in the air. It happened when I mentioned Eartha Kitt became Catwoman. It happened when Billy Dee Williams became a very incidental Harvey Dent. Geeks don't like change. And so is it worth it? I don't know. Not if it gets in the way of the story, but I do think you can have an interesting thing. And to me, okay, this is probably something I shouldn't admit at the Batman conference. I am not a Batman fan. I love Batman as an idea, and everybody around Batman is more interesting than Batman himself. Tim Drake, Dick Grayson, Stephanie, Carrie, Cassandra, Barbara, now Duke, every single character around Batman is this greater idea that, like, when, to me, it's like, can Batman beat Superman? Of course, because Batman has a plan for that. Batman has a plan for everything. Batman is nigh godlike in his ubermenschness, as we were, you know, in the last previous panel. So to me, the interesting story is, and it hasn't happened yet, but I want to see Duke Thomas existing in the world of Batman as this one black character who has to navigate the complex world that Bruce has forced everyone else to live in. That's what makes Tim interesting. That's what makes Dixon, what makes all of them interesting. So I'd rather see that more so than just, what if Bruce Wayne's black one day?
Just to be clear, I didn't suggest.
Yeah, I know. But I mean, that's the best way I can answer the question. It's the best way I can answer the question for me.
But can we... So maybe we can't have it both ways. So maybe I can't stand sort of in both camps here. But I think kind of on the one hand, I again as the conservative want to say, now any ideological approach is always bad because ideologies end up with, you know, killing lots and lots of people in the long run, and I don't want to see that even in comic books. But I would say any attempt to create a meta narrative, whether it's the alt-right or whoever. I'm gonna say let's maybe not try to read the world as that sort of thing, but on the other hand, this idea of whether or not Batman could be black, obviously that is a question for Batman fans and DC comic artists.
Sure,
and I can't answer that, but just increasing the number of minorities in the Batman world, even if it's just people walking by on the street, I realize that that's not going to, you know, get rid of 80 years of not having that. That will never.
But it does
change.
Make it better.
Yeah. So what will it look like 80 years from now?
I think you'll have more Duke Thomases in the world.
Right. So yeah. So down the road, if that decision is made, mm-hmm. Again, if there is an organic way to do it rather than an ideological way to do it, you know, if there's a way to work it into the storylines now mm-hmm. that makes sense and that is being faithful to character and plot and so on. I don't know why you wouldn't do that.
And they figured out to do that in 2017. I mean, like, that's how long it took for them to say, oh, well, why doesn't he have a black sidekick? Because he's got 18 other sidekicks. And so they just, like, added one all of a sudden. And that's who Duke is. So
just as to comment, I mean, isn't the Miles Morales template for this, like, the
legacy
the
superhero,
hopeful, you know, like, I mean, Into the Spider-Verse was incredibly well received. Mm-hmm. Like, that is a movie where I bet a lot of people went like, wait, a half black, half Hispanic Spider-Man, not in my town, and walked out going like, all right, Miles, like that, like mm-hmm. a lot of people got behind that.
And the secret is making a good movie.
Right. Well, that was the thing, right? They put money behind it and they said, like, we want to do this. And we're going to have Peter Parker, like, usher this guy in and say, mm-hmm. you're the man now. Isn't that a good template for mm-hmm. a way forward, I guess?
Sure. And the Miles Morales comic book has been
right.
super successful over time.
And I think that... I was going to push back on you for that very reason, actually. I think that doing something to instigate the conversation is one of the ways in which these comics
absolutely
could maybe produce those changes in society. And I do wonder, though, if Marvel seems to have less of a problem with this than DC. And I wonder if it's because Marvel started up in a more kind of radical era, like in the 60s, right? And so they didn't inherit.
I think there's also a difference.
The nostalgia isn't so much a problem for Marvel getting in the way of these.
I'll tell you
changes.
Not. So for the pushback, because I actually think you're right. But here's the difference. I never, and I don't know who's a Miles Morales fan. Raise your hand. Okay. Every time we've mentioned him so far, I've never called him the Black Spider-Man. I never think of him that way. I there's a guy named Spider-Man. If you say Spider-Man and you just generically say his name, I'll assume you mean Peter. If I want to talk about Miles Morales, I don't care about the character of Spider-Man. I'm a fan of the character Miles Morales. Mm-hmm. I'm not there with Duke Thomas yet because he hasn't been around long enough to really grab me, and the storyline hasn't been great. It's okay. And also the Signal is a really stupid name, which is his superhero name.
Yep.
But it's just dumb, so I hope they come up with something better. But like, I'm not, like, I don't think of Miles as the Black Spider-Man. I think of him as a new character. I do the same. I'm a little more okay calling Kamala Khan Ms. Marvel, but she's not, she's only tenuously connected to any of the other Ms. Marvel characters, you know, to Carol Danvers. So it's, to me, she's, you know, she's sort of, I'm interested in them building on the universe, sure, and, you know, building diversity. But I think that Marvel has been able to do that by Kamala and Miles are characters first, and Duke kind of feels like an attempt to add a Black guy to the Batman story. and it really is a huge, I mean, yes, I'm sure there's a corporate edict to diversify from Marvel. I know that they had a marketing campaign based around it, but it felt more organic than just sort of, and look over there, there's my Black friend, which is how Duke feels to me.
Well, I think part of the reason it feels more organic is because of Marvel's just history, mm-hmm. right? It doesn't have the baggage. I think, Matt.
Yeah, so I had two thoughts. one, kind of push back something you said, Coyle. Just getting some clarification what you mean by as long as they're not ideologically driven. Because my general mentality there would be that, like, to try to find some neutral, non-ideological space.
Yeah, so I would actually say exactly what you just said, right? The corporate memo put a minority in here, right? That is an ideological thing. Versus, we're telling this story, and the character is a minority, and it works better. So again, I think Miles Morales versus
I would, yeah, I mean, I would, I think I don't want to fall into a discussion of term, because I wouldn't call that sure. ideology. I would have called that corporate interference. I mean, I would have called that edict. I mean, I happen to know that there was an edict. Again, Marvel didn't hide that. They literally, they had a campaign about diversity. Falcon will now be Captain America and Black. Thor will now be a woman. Miles Morales will be an important character. Kamala, like they made posters. Like, so they're not hiding it.
Sure.
But, and some of those stories came off better than others. I thought the Sam Wilson, who's one of my favorite characters as Cap, was awful. I understand why I was supposed to like it. I did not. And I've talked about it before. But in a good world, I'm allowed to make those decisions, right? Like the reason it was hard was because when they did that, how many other options for a Black superhero did you have? And that's what you want, is you want for corporate to step in and make it universal enough that I'm allowed to not like something. And I don't have to just keep reading it because it's the only Black comic there is. And that's, you get there eventually. And I think it's better. I think it's better at Marvel right now than it is at DC. I think there are more Marvel options.
When Scott Peterson kind of came up with Cassandra Cain, he wanted a Batgirl because there was no active Batgirls. And it was like Batgirl first and foremost. And then he was like, and let's make her Asian because there's a lot of white people in the Batcave. Like, I was just quote.
Yeah.
So it was like Batgirl first, and then, well, why not a non-white character, which I think helps. It never really – I don't remember it being brought up until, like, near the end of her series that she actually was – you know, obviously she was Asian, but, like, it wasn't explicitly in the dialogue until, like, later on, which, you know, is kind of – might be problematic, but, like, it was – I think it helped normalize her in a lot of fans' mm-hmm. experiences.
She's a good example, I think. I mean, and again, we were talking about this at dinner yesterday, where she was almost an accidental character. I mean, that character was supposed to be Huntress originally, and it crazy behind the scenes stuff happens. But at least in that one, it was natural. I mean, she was a character first, and she doesn't feel like Batman's Asian friend.
Yeah. Like, what about Batwing?
I think you had a question over here.
I forgot.
I wanted to question the line between a character that is organic and a character that is being introduced by mandate, because I think there's no such thing as a character that is organic. Every single character, every single choice about every single character mm-hmm. is political and is made
Absolutely.
By human beings. So I think that the idea that, you know, Marvel is an entity that has an easier time because they don't have baggage, no offense, I just... can't agree with that because Marvel is made up of human beings making decisions, and so is DC.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. People at DC can make different decisions.
Absolutely.
The ones that they have made and the ones they continue to make, mm-hmm. which is if a new character arrives, they're generally white because the person hasn't thought to question why they should not be white
mm-hmm.
or why white is the default. And so I think in that environment, if a writer does not think of that themselves or an artist does not think of that themselves, then I don't think we should have a problem with an editor saying, have you considered that maybe you should question that this brand new character is white and male? Defend that rather than when we're always asking people to defend, why did you make them a woman? Why did you make them a person of color?
Yeah, I agree with you 100% that wasn't my point at all. I think you're right.
I know.
Yeah.
But I think that you know, a few people together and, you know, the last mm-hmm. couple of days, there's been this idea about some things kind of develop naturally and other things are forced. And I
totally agree with you. Let me just clarify, because I didn't speak well then, I guess. What I'm saying is Marvel's developed these characters at a time when they were making those political decisions. And so the relative ease with which they've diversified their superhero, stable, I think comes out of that material mm-hmm. moment, right? Whereas DC was developing these characters before that political moment. Mm-hmm. And so the baggage that they have is sort of one of nostalgia, right? Mm-hmm. And so I would go back to the show that I have out right now is about Mark Fisher's book, Capitalist Realism, which is a little bit about the way in which nostalgia preforms your imagination, right? And so DC's writers and the business of DC is dealing with this nostalgia that Marvel came up at a time that was a little bit past. That's what I meant. I totally agree that they're all political decisions.
Mm-hmm.
I think that those political decisions came out of different eras, and that's mm-hmm. one reason that you might point to. I totally agree with what you said.
Yeah. And the fan bases. I think that. So I think the way you phrased it originally, nothing's really organic. 100% agree. Because I don't think it's so much that it is organic. I think that they're able to sell it as such better. And I think that's important because it really, I mean, what I said before, Duke doesn't feel organic to me. And I understand it. Like, I understand what's going on. And it still feels like he's, God, I'm as liberal as they come. But if somebody says, I'm reading Batman and it feels like you're pushing your SJW agenda on me with this Duke Thomas, I get it, because it does feel like that. Like, again, I want to like him. It's just that there's not enough there yet. There's not enough there yet in the way that if suddenly Kamala Khan has a transgender Asian, literally every buzzword friend, I'll go, okay, yeah, that scans. Like, I would never question it because it feels more natural, because the book earned it in a way that Batman hasn't yet, and maybe he should have. But she does have a transgender friend. I just remember, is that what
that's
you're gonna say?
What I'm for.
Oh.
No. So what do you think of Batwing, Duke Thomas?
I don't know enough about. I'm aware of Batwing. I've never read that book.
Which one? Well, right.
Yeah.
Because there's one who's from continental Africa itself, right?
Yeah.
And there's Lucas Fox.
Lucas. Yeah, I never read. Yeah, that was during the Batman Incorporated days, and I'm like, I don't care.
Well, now I'm a detective.
He's a detective.
Oh, is he a detective now?
Yeah.
Okay, I'm not reading. I should look it up. I'll have to look that.
Yeah, he's part of the whole group. The Belfry.
Yeah, but they mm-hmm. they kind of dropped that group thing.
Yeah, that was like a year ago. That was a while ago.
Yeah. It's been like 10 issues since we've seen them. He's somewhere.
Yeah. He's alive.
And that's the thing with, like, characters like Duke Thomas. Like, you'll have a writer that will kind of, try and introduce this character, but unless the rest of DC kind of champions them, once, like, a writer ends their run, everyone kind of defaults to, like, characters from the animated series or a classic era, and, like, no one's really, with Scott Snyder not on the Bat books, no one's really using Duke Thomas now. Everyone's kind of doing their own thing, and if they're bringing back characters, it's like, oh, well, Alfred, Commissioner Gordon, Harvey Bullock, every character that was created before the Reagan administration.
That's the pre-formation
then,
I'm talking about.
Usually you'll get someone like Tim Drake or Jason Todd who will survive that before the Reagan administration rule, but it's hard.
Yeah. I guess I don't know if we have time to talk about this because I'm not sure what time we're supposed to stop. But I'm sort of curious, and again, you guys will know this far more than I will, but the question of organically adding someone to Marvel, if we can use that phrase, which, again, you guys are right to sort of question whether that's good.
Can we define those two terms, then?
I don't think there is one. That's what you're getting at.
Artistically, correctly, or in a way that feels natural, but mm-hmm. as opposed to, like you pointed out.
I think it's a myth. I think it's largely a... It's a perception problem. It's just like the war between Marvel and DC doesn't exist. Nobody who works there cares.
Right.
But the fan base sees that because I'm a Marvel guy because Stan said that in a column 40 years ago. And you become a Marvel guy and people internalized it. So I think that when stuff fits the internal narrative that sort of has been built, it just meshes in better. And DC tried for a long time to have Gods Among Men, and Marvel tried for a long time, and this was in the 60s, to have street level characters who are struggling to pay their rent. So certain things just feel more natural. There's no reason why you can't have a street level character trying to pay his rent in DC. That's what Kyle Rayner was until he became a God Among Men.
Well, and I guess my question was going to be, is it easier to add more characters of whatever type to Marvel just because so much of their bigger stuff is group based, Avengers, X-Men, so on? You can just add people into that in a way that DC is Superman, Batman. I mean, yeah, there's the Justice League, but even then
there's Titans, there's Outsiders.
I think the options are always there.
I think it's just a perception problem.
Fair enough.
Yep.
Lack of imagination.
Yep.
I gather we're out of time. Yep. I don't know. So I'm getting the wrap up. Can we take one more question?
No, I was about to clap for you.
Oh, okay.
Well, thank you.
You guys are doing awesome. Thanks for your great questions.
Just because it's my show, I have to say, so we've resolved nothing, but...
we totally fixed that.
Yeah. Waste of time. It wasn't an organic conversation. That conversation was very forced.
We had
thank you, everybody.
SJW agenda.
And thank you, listeners, for tuning in. Once again, that was a panel presentation at the Batman and Popular Culture Conference commemorating the 80th anniversary of Batman, held at Bowling Green State University, hosted by their Department of Popular Culture. You've been listening to the City of Man podcast. We are part of the Christian Humanist Radio Network. Our press liaison is Kristen Filippic. Please check out other podcasts in our family. Get more information about our own show or our show notes by visiting christianhumanist.org. Please do leave us a review on iTunes to help other people find our show. Like our Facebook page at facebook.com/cityofmanpodcast or get in touch with us at cityofmanpodcast@gmail.com. This is Coyle Neal, and on behalf of Ed Song, let me remind you to render unto Caesar those things that are Caesar's, render unto God those things that are God, and let me send you out with some wise words from the Joker. Yeah.